You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Let's start with our motivation. So all of us value compassion and see it as something important in our lives to cultivate. But it's important to have wisdom together with our compassion. Otherwise, our compassion becomes people-pleasing, or it becomes Mickey Mouse compassion, or we start manipulating other people or being manipulated by them, all in the name of compassion. And that happens because we lack wisdom. So it's especially important to be very clear what is going on in our mind. Are we operating out of our own needs, or are we operating out of genuine care for the welfare of others? Do we know what our limit is, or do we push ourselves beyond our limit? Are we able to discern when we're the right person to help someone, or do we jump in and help thinking that others are going to be damned unless we save them? So we have to get to know ourselves pretty well and look at these kinds of psychological things going on in our mind so that we can have pure compassion, not Mickey Mouse compassion. So doing that requires a lot of honesty, being astute in the way we examine our mind and our interactions with others, and also learning from our mistakes. So when things don't go the way we would like them to, when we're blamed, when we're trying to help someone, when we collapse because we're exhausted, when we're disappointed because others don't take our advice, and those are opportunities for great learning. And we have to really look inside of ourselves and see what brought those situations on, and then correct them so that our compassion can be genuine and not polluted. So let's have that motivation to refine our compassion, to generate wisdom of all kinds, many different kinds of wisdom, so that we can become a fully awakened Buddha and be of the greatest service to other living beings. So looking, being mindful of what's going on in our mind when we're trying to benefit others is incredibly important. Otherwise we get really tangled up, yeah, and wind up with a mess, you know, a messy situation, or with our own mind in a mess, or with the other person's mind in a mess, or you know, something like that, because you know, we don't really know what's motivating us. Yeah. instead of having genuine care for others that knows, you know, when we're the correct person to help, what kind of help somebody needs, what kind of help they don't need, you know, when it's important to say no or when it's important to back off. Yeah, without that kind of self-knowledge, then we often wind up, you know, well, you know what it's like, haven't we all done that? Yeah? We step in, I'm going to save somebody, they need me, and only me, and I'm the one who's going to rescue them from all their problems, whether they want to be rescued or not. And I'm going to rescue them in the way I want them to be rescued so that they become what I want them to be, not what they want to be. And, you know, and so on and so on. And then when they don't appreciate it, we're upset, we blame them. So very important to have self-knowledge when we're or self-awareness when we're cultivating compassion. So I think one way to gain that self-awareness is review the situations in which we've tried to be compassionate and it's worked out poorly. Yeah. And then to say, okay, what was going on there? What was the mechanism between me and the other person that was happening? What was I expecting? You know, what was I operating out of some kind of need that I wasn't aware of? Was I trying to prove myself? You know, make myself worthy? What was really motivating me? And so it's really by going through those past situations and looking at, you know, what went wrong, that's how we learn and that's how we'll be more aware of what to watch out for in the future so we can avoid our own messy motivations. Okay. So, even His Holiness was, His Holiness, Nagarjuna, was, you know, we started this section about the Mahayana teachings being valuable and being the teachings of the Buddha. So I just want to review the last couple of verses that we did before we go ahead. So, 368 and 369, those who deride the universal vehicle, in other words, the Mahayana, called the universal vehicle because our motivation is to universally benefit all sentient beings equally. So those who deride the universal vehicle either cannot distinguish good qualities from faults, or they mistake good qualities for faults, or else they despise good qualities. Okay, well what, and then here he's going to clarify what, the next verse, what's a good quality and what's a fault. What harms others are faults, what helps them are good qualities. Recognizing this, it is said that those who deride the universal vehicle dislike good qualities. Okay, so, you know, bodhisattvas emphasize others' welfare more than their own welfare. So that's something that most people would see as admirable. Yeah, but sometimes it happens that people don't see that as admirable. And so why not? Well, maybe they can't distinguish good qualities from faults. So they don't see working for the welfare of others as a good quality, and seeking one's own liberation as a fault. Now, why would people not see that? Okay, why wouldn't they see working for others as a good quality and working for your own liberation as a shortcoming? Now, why? And here's where the self-centered mind comes in. The self-centered mind being the mind that is attached to our own liberation, that seeks our own liberation. Now, why would somebody seek their own liberation rather than the noble motivation of, you know, attaining awakening to be able to benefit all beings? Well, one reason is they may say, and it was very interesting, when I was in Thailand and stayed at the monastery, I heard people say these kind of things. I was quite surprised. So there was one person who said, it's unrealistic trying to be of benefit to all other living beings. Yeah, it's totally unrealistic. How can I lead them all to awakening? That's just fantasy. Another person said, well, the best thing I can do to benefit others is get myself out of samsara. Then I stop becoming a harm to them. So my own liberation is the thing I'm aiming for, and nothing more, because that's the best thing I can do for others. And another person said, you know, samsara is just hell. I want to get out as fast as I can. Bodhisattva path, three countless great eons of accumulating merit. And that's once you've even started the path of accumulation, which I haven't even started. And the idea of three countless great eons of doing this in samsara is just too much. You know, I can't bear it. I need to get out of my samsara right away. So people have these kinds of thoughts. So from Nagarjuna's viewpoint, you can understand how people would think that way, but then how could you think that not being of the greatest benefit to all beings was something that was most profound, the most admirable? Okay? So we say, yes, it's most profound, most admirable. And then when it comes to acting for the benefit of sentient beings, we chicken out. Yeah? The other people maybe are a little bit more honest about their self-centeredness, you know? But for us, we just kind of make some excuse or chicken out. Yeah? Those are over little things. I'm not talking about big, big acts of compassion. Okay, so some people may mistake good qualities for faults, so they think relinquishing working for your own welfare and striving for others' benefit is a fault, because better to get yourself out of samsara so you don't harm anybody else. Or some people just have a spontaneous dislike for the qualities of the Mahayana. And so this could be because they lack imprints from encountering it in previous lives. Yeah. And so if we really have high regard for the Mahayana now and want to continue that in future lives, then it's very important to set as many imprints in our mind as possible, so that next lifetime we can not only meet the Mahayana teachings, but also have interest in them and want to practice them. Okay. So then, verse 370 and 371. By being unconcerned about one's own aims, one takes delight uniquely in the aims of others. This source of all good qualities is the teaching of the universal vehicle. Here, one who disparages it is tormented. Even a faithful person suffers due to misunderstanding it. Someone else who is hostile suffers due to animosity. If it is said that even the faithful person is tormented, what about the one who is hostile? Okay. So relinquishing our self-centeredness, including the self-centered motivation for our own liberation, and instead working for others, is the source of all peace and happiness in the world. Yeah, and disparaging this kind of, altruistic intention is extremely destructive and creates a ton of negative karma, which would cause one to fall to a lower rebirth or to not, meet the Mahayana teachings in future lives. So there's two kinds of people who are hostile towards the universal vehicle. Some of those are, the first group, are those who have faith in emptiness and want to realize it, but they don't know how to think about emptiness properly, and instead they mistakenly think that nothing exists, that emptiness means nothing whatsoever exists. And they dislike the Mahayana teachings for that reason. Okay? So some people dislike the Mahayana teachings because of their teachings on compassion and altruism. Other people dislike the Mahayana teachings because of the way emptiness is taught in the Mahayana. Okay? So as Geshe-la mentioned, the hearers and solitary realizers and bodhisattvas all realize the same emptiness. Emptiness is taught in a very brief, the emptiness of inherent existence is taught in a brief way in the fundamental vehicle scriptures. Okay? But what's taught in a more expanded way in those scriptures is the lack of a permanent, partless, independent soul or self, and the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. So those are taught more prominently. Yeah. So when people, they can still realize emptiness through studying the Fundamental Vehicle Sutras, yeah, but it isn't elaborated on, extensively. So when they hear emptiness elaborated on extensively in the Mahayana, then they go, oh, this is nihilistic, it's saying that nothing whatsoever exists, and that freaks me out. So they disparage the Mahayana for that reason, over the emptiness teachings, not over the compassion teachings. Okay. Then another group of people are actively hostile towards the universal vehicle teachings because they really dislike the teachings on emptiness. They have, a lot of animosity towards those teachings, or they really object to the teachings that encourage us to give up working for our own welfare alone. They really object to those teachings. So if even the first group of people who, wants to understand emptiness but misunderstands it, it creates a lot of negative karma and have a bad rebirth as a result of it, then what about the people who are actively hostile towards those teachings? They're creating really bad karma. Okay? So there's a difference between being hostile to teachings and debating the teachings. Okay? Because there may be a teaching that we may not understand, that we may disagree with, and we debate and we question and we want to learn and we want to understand. And that's very much in the Nalanda tradition, very much in the Indian way of doing things. But there, your motivation is, I want to learn. I want to see what is the actual truth. And I've got to debate it and debate the views until I get to the bottom of this and really understand how things exist. So that person is engaged in philosophical debate, but they don't have animosity towards the teachings, even though they may not agree with them right away. Okay? So you've got to understand the difference here. Otherwise, we will misunderstand and think that we just have to accept the teachings on blind faith, because otherwise we're creating negative karma. And that's not the case at all. Okay, it's really important to question and investigate the teachings. Okay. One other point along this line, when talking about the teachings, is there's many points that are discussed in the Fundamental Vehicle Teaching in an abbreviated way, that then are really unpacked and fleshed out in the Mahayana teachings. Okay? So, like I was saying last week, the four immeasurables are taught, you know, and, you know, they're very powerful and they're practiced in the Fundamental Vehicle and also in the Mahayana. The Mahayana takes the four immeasurables another step.
You said four measurables, four noble truths.
No, four measurables. Okay. Takes the four immeasurables another step and uses them as the basis for generating bodhicitta. Because the four immeasurables themselves are not bodhicitta. Okay? They're the basis for it. So the Mahayana takes that as a basis and says, okay, let's overcome our self-centered thought completely and work for the benefit of others and through that motivation purify our mind of all defilements and become a Buddha. Okay, so it takes it another level. In the Fundamental Vehicle scriptures, they talk about nirvana, what is true cessation, but not elaborately. In the Mahayana scriptures, especially the Prajnaparamita scriptures, there emptiness is really fleshed out completely and extensively. Okay, what is true cessation? You know, what is true path? What is really Buddha nature? How is it possible for everybody to become a Buddha? How does Buddha nature relate to true path and true cessations? All that comes about in the Mahayana teachings. Okay. Then, 372. Physicians say that poison may be eliminated with poison. So how is it contradictory to say that suffering may eliminate something unhelpful? Okay. So this is talking about... you know, some in the Mahayana teachings, they talk about, you know, giving your body for the benefit of others or, you know, just giving up all our self-concern in order to benefit others. And that leaves us more open to suffering ourselves. It makes us more vulnerable. Okay? And so for some people, the idea of giving away your body or just the idea of, you know, giving up trying to have a good reputation or, you know, giving up getting your way or who knows what it is. But it just scares people, it frightens people, and they don't want any portion of that. So they, you know, being unable to tolerate it, they get upset and angry. So some people don't want to tolerate even the slightest small suffering for the benefit of others, let alone a big suffering, giving away your family, giving away, you know, not caring about your reputation, giving up your possessions, and all these kinds of things. And what this verse is saying is that when you're suffering, let's say with a physical ailment, the doctors give you medicine to counteract it. The medicine is often poison. Okay? Poison in small doses becomes medicine. So that's where it says physicians say that poison may be eliminated with poison. Okay? Because any medicine is actually a poison of sorts, isn't it? But you have to take it in the right amount. And if you take too much of it, it does poison your body. Okay? But the idea here is that, you know, when you're suffering, when it's saying here, the example of poison is when you have a big poison and you're very sick, taking a little poison to eliminate your illness is something smart. Okay? So similarly, if we have a big suffering in samsara, having to undergo a small suffering in order to attain full awakening is worthwhile, because undergoing the small suffering purifies the karma that leads us to have a big suffering. Okay? So it's the same way that if you, if you break a limb or something like that, you're in excruciating pain. You have to undergo surgery to reset your limb. The surgery is painful, but you willingly undergo the surgery because it's to counteract the greater pain of having a broken limb. Okay? So the idea being, when you have some horrible pain, undergoing a small pain to alleviate the horrible pain is something, you know, any person who's thinking correctly would certainly do. Okay? So in the same way that, in samsara, suffering comes to us all the time. And if we can free ourselves from suffering by practicing the bodhisattva path, which involves a small suffering compared to the big suffering of samsara, then it's worth it. Okay? The idea being here that, you know, whether we practice the Mahayana or the fundamental vehicle, we have to go through some suffering in order to purify our mind and get out of cyclic existence and reach our own spiritual aim. Yeah, we have to. When you keep precepts, yeah, there's some discomfort involved, isn't there? Yeah, your precepts push your buttons. You know, you like singing, now you can't sing. You like dancing, now you can't dance. You like sex, that's out of the question now too. You know? So there's some difficulty that you undergo, but you know why you're undergoing that difficulty. It's not self-torture, it's not sadism. Sadism is harming yourself, or is that masochism? Masochism is harming yourself. Masochism. So it's not masochistic, yeah. But it's done for a wise purpose, to free ourselves of a bigger suffering. Because when we keep precepts, we stop creating negative karma, we create a ton of virtue, that leads us to much happiness in the future. So undergoing, you know, a little bit of suffering in order to keep our precepts well is certainly worthwhile. So along that same line, you know, if we have to undergo a little bit of suffering, you know, to practice the Mahayana teachings for the purpose of attaining the great bliss of Buddhahood, in which we fulfilled our own purpose and others' purpose, then it's certainly the right thing to do, isn't it? You know, and we're going to have some courage and some fortitude. So we don't go looking for suffering, but when suffering comes to us, you know, we have a courageous mind, and we don't just kind of melt, in front of having to give something up. OK? Okay. Like tomorrow is precept day, so we'll eat only one meal a day. Yeah. So maybe that involves some suffering. Yeah? You get hungry in the morning or you get hungry in the evening. Yeah? Whatever it is, or maybe, you know, the other precepts, no entertainment. Yeah. You know, so there's things that we can't do. Say, oh, that's suffering. But why are we doing that? You know, when we take the ceremony, we're telling ourselves, you know, it's to prevent famine, to prevent, you know, all kinds of maladies from befalling the world and befalling ourselves. Okay, so you undertake it gratefully. When you go to college to get your degree, do you undergo suffering? You do, don't you? Yeah, you have to read boring stuff, you have to take exams, somebody critiques your stuff and sends it back, and you have to redo it, and other people do better than you, and you don't get the grades you want, and then your family's unhappy, and you're unhappy, and, you know, yeah. But you do it, don't you? Why? What's your reward at the end? Getting a good job and getting some money. So you undergo the suffering, don't you, of going to school to get an education so you can go get money, so you can go get your speedboat and your flashy red car. Okay? And, you know, whatever else it is you want. But you undergo that happily. So, you know, if we really value full awakening, then undergoing some small discomfort for that sake, you know, it's not ridiculous. It makes a lot of sense. Okay, 373. So it's refuting it's refuting our cowardice. Yeah. Are you cowardly? Uncowardly? Yeah. In my meditation, I think, yes, I will, you know, give a kidney to somebody. Yes, I will, you know, do this. Yes, I will do that. I will imagine it. But if somebody called me tomorrow and said, I'm dying unless, you know, I have a kidney transplant and you're the one to give me the kidney, I don't know. My kidney? Then I only have one kidney? Then what's going to happen to me? I'll only have one kidney? And besides, I have to have an operation when I don't need one? And I could get infections after the operation. Why do I want to give a kidney to somebody else? Now, I come up with a ton of good reasons why not to do it. Yeah? But in my meditation, yes, I'll give you 10,000 kidneys. I'll endure anything. So you start with the imagination. If you don't start with your imagination, you'll never get to actually doing it. But imagining it is not the same thing as doing it. Yeah?
What if a monk in Singapore actually gave his kidney to a stranger?
Yeah. So some people do that. That's really quite admirable. Yeah, a monk in Singapore did that. Okay. So the scriptures maintain the mind is the prerequisite for all dharmas. The mind is the principal factor in creating karma. So if one does something helpful with the intention to be helpful, how could it be unhelpful even if suffering is involved? And 374, if one does something unpleasant that will later be helpful, then what about doing something for oneself and for others that is both pleasant and helpful? This is an ancient principle. Okay, so, being confident in the great benefit that giving up just working for ourselves and taking care of ourselves and being preoccupied with our own happiness, giving up that kind of concern and working for others will bring much goodness in the future to ourselves and others. And so we should feel confident in that, you know, to really understand karma and understand that when you create good karma, the result is definitely going to come. Okay. Now, a question comes here. Okay. If we do something helpful with the intention to be helpful, how could it be unhelpful even if suffering is involved? Okay. So if we have a good intention to benefit somebody and we do something, that is helpful, then even if we suffer, how could the action be bad? Okay? So if we have a good motivation, we're doing a virtuous action that benefits others, even if we're inconvenienced, even if we undergo a little bit of pain or whatever, how could that be something bad? It's not something bad. Okay? So this is when we're acting with a pure motivation to benefit others. The motivation I gave at the beginning of the talk, you know, we may be doing something to benefit that we think we have compassion for and we think will benefit others, but we're doing it out of ignorance, and then we experience suffering because maybe the other person, you know, rejects what we're doing or blames us or whatever. In those kind of situations, yes, there's something good from having some kind of compassion, but our action also was motivated by ignorance, or perhaps was motivated by subtle attachment or subtle anger, some kind of subtle clinging, or maybe not so subtle clinging. It's just, it's a very gross clinging, and everybody else in the world knows we have this problem but us. Yeah? So that could be a situation where, you know, we may suffer as a result, but, and we think we're doing good, but because we're motivated by ignorance or clinging, and we're not really, our motivation is really kind of mixed, then that's a different case than what we're talking about here. Okay. You know how it is when you go to help somebody, and then afterwards they get mad at you. You ever had that happen? Oh, only me. So I'll tell you my story since you never had it happen. So, some years ago, there was a young man who, I knew him because I had gone to his Dharma center to teach. And he started seeing double, and it wound up that he had a brain tumor. And he was in his 20s, he was going to have to go in for brain surgery. And it's scary. Brain surgery is scary no matter what your age, but especially when you're 20-something and it's the beginning of your life and you never thought that you would have something serious like this. Yeah, and, you know, whenever there's brain surgery, who knows what could go wrong and how you'll come out of the surgery. So I did my best, you know, to kind of talk to him, you know, because the surgery was still a few weeks away, so, you know, talk to him and counsel him and discuss the fears and prepare how to, you know, be prepared mentally for the surgery and everything like that. And so we worked together a lot on this. And then it was very interesting, after the surgery, I don't know what happened. He got very angry at me. Yeah? I don't know what happened. You know? So I was puzzled. I wasn't angry in return. Yeah? I've had other incidents when people don't repay my kindness where I've been really upset. But in this particular situation, I wasn't. I just thought, whatever, you know, I did my best and I feel good about what I did. And he got through the surgery well and recovered well, so that was good. But then another time, I remember, with another student helping them, and then that person turned their back and, like, blah, you know, did something really, really mean, and I was like, ah, you know? And I had to I went into retreat after that, very fortunately, and really saw that my motivation had been quite polluted, and that my pain was due to the pollution in my motivation, that I had expectation of something. Yeah, that was, you know, you don't expect. Yeah, no expectations is a very good policy. Yeah, and so if you have that kind of mind, then you do what you do, and you're happy with what you do, no matter, you know, what the person says or does afterwards. Okay. But if one does something unpleasant that will later be helpful, yeah? So here you're looking in the long term. Yeah, the first situation was you have a good intention and a good action. So, yeah, even if there's some suffering involved, it's still something quite good. Here is we're doing something unpleasant in the short term, so we're suffering in the short term, but the action we're doing will later be helpful. Okay, so in that case, it's definitely something we should do. Okay, because the long-term benefit is more important than the short-term benefit. So if that's the case, then the verse is saying, what about doing something that benefits yourself and others, that is both pleasant and helpful now and in the future? Then that's certainly going to be something to do, isn't it? Okay, so what is that? Is going to be generating bodhicitta. Okay, so this is also in response to Joe Blow, who says, sometimes people have a good motivation, but their physical or verbal actions cause problems. It's true, isn't it? Okay, so if you're acting with a good motivation, then even though the immediate result may be some kind of confusion, you're acting with good intention, and that will bring good results for you in the future life. Okay. Yeah. So when bodhisattvas undergo the hardship of giving away their body, they do so with a very strong, virtuous motivation. And so then, despite the temporary suffering of giving away parts of their body, you know, their mind is quite happy because they know in the long term what they're doing is going to be of great benefit, you know, and in the short term it's directly benefiting somebody else. Okay. So this practice of bearing a smaller pain for a greater good is done by the Buddhas of the past, present, and future. Okay, so we should emulate that kind of thing. Something's good in the long term, we should definitely do it. Okay, so all of this is trying to get us to overcome our skittishness? Skittishness when it comes to being inconvenienced or having anything unpleasant. But, okay, then 375 and 376. If one will later attain great happiness from forsaking some trivial pleasure now, then sensible people, realizing that they will gain great happiness, should abandon that trifling pleasure now. Okay, it makes great sense, doesn't it? When It comes to doing it, to us giving up some trifling or trivial pleasure now for some greater good. Do we do that? No. Okay. So there may be some kind of food that is not good for us, but we like it. We eat it anyway, even though in the long term it harms our body. Or there might be some food that's very fattening. We have a problem with cholesterol or overweight. We still eat the food, even though it's harming ourselves, you know, in the long term. Yeah? We sentient beings are, even in this lifetime, you know, forget believing in karma and getting a good result in future lifetime. You know, we don't want to put off our happiness even for our own benefit, do we? Yeah? When we really think of it, sometimes the stupid things we've done, because we want to do them right now because they're going to bring us pleasure right now, even though they're going to make a mess for the future, we just shine it on, don't we? You know? Give me my pleasure right now. And then we wonder, you know, why we have bad health, why we're in a difficult situation. Who knows what it is, yeah? Okay, because we just, we're gluttons for pleasure. Isn't it? You know, and it's difficult, it's going to be difficult, no matter whether you follow the fundamental vehicle or the Mahayana vehicle, to attain our spiritual aims if we're gluttons for pleasure. Yeah? Why? Not because pleasure is bad. Nothing's wrong with experiencing pleasure. But because what we do to get pleasure creates negative karma. And because our mind becomes completely weak and infantile when it comes to seeking our own pleasure. Doesn't it? Yeah? Do you get infantile? I want this, I want this, why can't I have it? Somebody else has it, why shouldn't I have it? Yeah? Okay. If you cannot bear this, yeah, then healers and such who prescribe bitter medicine would disappear. And that makes no sense. So if we can't endure any pain or discomfort for something that's really good, then all the doctors will go out of business. Because nobody's going to take their treatment and their medicine. Yeah. Because inevitably, when you go to the doctor when you're sick to get treatment, it's something, you know, that is inconvenient at best and painful otherwise, isn't it? You have to take bitter medicine. Yeah, they give you antibiotics, then you have the runs. Yeah, then you know, the medicine doesn't taste good, or the medicine has side effects, or, you know, we want medicine that is sugar-coated and tastes good and heals us instantaneously, you know? So even if we have a broken limb, you know, there shouldn't be any pain involved in setting it. You know, if we don't take care of our body and we fall ill, if we don't take care of our body and we do stupid things and get injured, we think, you know, yeah, the doctor should be able to fix it all without pain. True or not true? Okay, so we have to kind of give this up. And Nagarjuna says, exert yourself for great happiness and don't be attached to small happiness. Okay. And 377, the wise see that in some cases what is usually harmful can be helpful. All treatises propose both general rules and exceptions. Okay, so here, okay, in cyclic existence, everything is in the nature of dukkha being unsatisfactory. And we always say dukkha is to be abandoned. So in that case, shouldn't we avoid doing any kind of action that causes us any pain, because that causes us dukkha, and dukkha is to be abandoned? This sounds like one of Joe Blow's arguments, doesn't it? Yeah? Yeah, we should abandon dukkha. If I, you know, have to forego my own happiness to benefit somebody else, that causes me suffering, and suffering is to be abandoned. So I shouldn't help somebody else because it causes me suffering. Yeah, sounds reasonable, huh? Right? This is what we tell ourselves many times. Yeah? So, while in general it's true suffering is to be abandoned, there are exceptions to the rule. Okay? So, because you'll see that the Buddhist treatises, and especially the Vinaya, they'll tell you the rule and then they tell you the exceptions. Why? Because not every situation is the same. And in certain circumstances, it's wise to act other than what the general rule says. Okay? So one example here is, in general, we want to relinquish rebirth and cyclic existence, right? Okay? But for bodhisattvas who are motivated by compassion, they must take rebirth in samsara in order to accumulate the method aspect of the path. Yeah, and so they readily, happily, adjust and adopt that suffering because it's for a greater good. Yeah? Because by benefiting others now, they will be able to get themselves out of samsara by creating a lot of merit and be able to benefit others directly as well. Okay? So similarly, in general, we need to take care of our bodies. Yeah, it's important because our bodies are the basis for our Dharma practice. If we don't take care of our bodies and we get sick, we get injured, it's going to be difficult to practice. However, for bodhisattvas, especially Arya bodhisattvas, when the time is right and when giving their body will be beneficial to others, then they should do so without attachment. Okay? So in general, yeah, we need to take care of our bodies, but in the situation of bodhisattvas, motivated by compassion, seeking a great enlightenment, then giving their bodies is the thing to do. Okay? So they speak so much in the Jataka tales, in all the bodhisattva literature, about giving your body or giving away your family, giving away all your possessions, whatever it is that's most precious to you. And they use these very extreme examples in order to communicate to us how strong a bodhisattva's compassion is, that they're willing to undergo this kind of pain for the benefit of others and for their own, to actualize their own spiritual aims as well. Okay? So, we have to know that you're only allowed actually to give your body once you've become an Arya Bodhisattva. Because bodhisattvas who are not yet Aryas do not have control over the rebirth process. So if they give up their body, yeah, there's a danger that they, maybe some kind of karma will ripen and they won't have the most advantageous rebirth next time. And so because of that, they are not allowed to give up their bodies. But for Arya Bodhisattvas, then they're not only allowed to, but encouraged to, because they can control their rebirth process. But even in the case of Arya Bodhisattvas, when they give up their body, they're going to be looking at what is the situation, and in the long term, is this the best thing to do, or is it actually, you know, going to create some difficulties later on and not be the best thing to do? So it doesn't mean that once you're an Arya Bodhisattva, you know, automatically just say, okay, here, cut up my body. You always use wisdom to discern if it's something actually beneficial. Okay. Then 378, the universal vehicle says that all activities should be motivated by compassion and that wisdom will make them pure. What sensible person would deride this? Yeah, it's true, isn't it? Yeah, if you do your actions motivated by compassion and you have wisdom that understands emptiness, you know, that when it says make them pure, it means that you're purifying your virtuous actions by meditating that yourself is the agent who's doing it, the person that who's the object of your action, and the action itself, that all these three exist dependently and not inherently. And so seeing, they call this the circle of three, the agent, object, and action. Seeing this in a pure way by seeing it as dependently arising, not as inherently existent, then that's called purifying your virtue, okay? So bodhisattvas want to have virtue that's motivated by compassion and that's then purified by wisdom in this way. Okay? So, the universal vehicle teachings are based on compassion and wisdom, and everybody in the world appreciates compassion and wisdom, don't they? Even secular people. Even people from other religions. Okay? So the point is there's nothing to disparage in the Mahayana teachings, you know, that are based on compassion and wisdom and that really, you know, instruct us along this line. Okay? And so the Mahayana teachings, you know, clearly explain all the bodhisattva practices, the six perfections or the six far-reaching practices in detail, how to practice them, you know, how to meditate on emptiness to realize the ultimate nature of reality, how to combine the method aspect of the path, you know, generosity and so on, with the wisdom aspect of the path. So all of that is explained in the Mahayana teachings. So what's not to like in them? Yeah? Mm-hmm. It's a good question, isn't it? What's not to like in this? Yeah. So I think what's not to like is when we feel personally threatened, you know? And instead of saying, I can't do this now, but I aspire to be able to do it in the future, and I really respect and admire the people who are able to do this now. So instead of seeing that, regarding it in that way, the person says, this is too hard. I can't do it. I'm insufficient. I don't like feeling insufficient. So this teaching must be bad. And it's not really necessary to follow this. Because they get on their own case and blame themselves because they're not able to do it. And so, because they don't feel happy that way, then they blame the teaching. You getting what I mean? Have you ever done that in your life? Yeah? You blame what is not
the cause.
What is not the cause of our suffering simply because we're unable to live up to our own expectations. Yeah. So the healthy way to deal with this is to be honest, which is, I'm not capable of doing this now, but I aspire to in the future. And know that by aspiring to, we plant the seeds in our mind to be able to do it. And then by appreciating and praising the people who are able to do this, then again, we encourage ourselves and put, you know, good seeds in our mind so that in the future we'll be successful in doing what at the present we're not able to do. Okay? So do you see what a big problem blaming ourselves becomes? Yeah? How counterproductive it is to practicing the path. Because it'll make us criticize something that is beautiful and to be practiced simply because it's too hard for us to do right now. Okay. Okay, 379. Discouraged by its vastness and profundity, ignorant persons, due to their confusion, today deride the universal vehicle, and thus become the foes of themselves and others. Okay, so we're discouraged by the vastness and profundity of the Mahayana teaching. So the vastness, working for the benefit of all sentient beings, creating vast ethical conduct, vast generosity, vast compassion, vast fortitude. Everything in Mahayana is over the top in vastness. So, you know, we get discouraged. Oh, I can't do that now. It's too hard. And we give up before we even try. And we don't consider that it's a process that's going to take us time. Yeah, and we judge ourselves. Or discouraged by the profundity of the Mahayana. So the teachings on emptiness, they're not easy, are they? Yeah. You have to, you know, really spend some time. Things exist, but they don't inherently exist. What does that mean? Yeah. Things are empty, but they're not non-existent. What? Yeah. And you know, and you'll find more and more of these kinds of things as we get into the Mahayana teachings. What is going on here? You know, this is just too hard to understand. And again, throw up our hands and say, well, I won't even try. It's too hard. You know, there's got to be an easier way to get to wisdom, you know, where I just sit there and empty my mind of all thoughts, and then whammo, the lightning's going to strike, and I'm going to become a Buddha. No, it doesn't usually work that way. Okay, so, you know, if we do deride the universal vehicle, the Mahayana teachings, then we're becoming our own enemy, and we're becoming the enemy of others. So Nagarjuna is saying, don't do that. You want to be happy, others want to be happy. Respect yourself, respect others, and create good causes. Okay. So any questions so far?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So just because this is where I'm at, I'm motivated by ignorance all the time.
You're what?
I'm motivated by ignorance all the time.
Yeah.
So isn't it still better to err on the side of trying to help and then doing what you're talking about? You know, we try and help, we see how it goes, mm-hmm. and then we learn from our mistakes. But, you know, this is almost tending towards saying, you know, you're motivated by ignorance.
Yeah. Okay, so you're saying, yes, we have ignorance in our mind. We can't see the situation clearly and know exactly what to do that is most beneficial to help the other person. So considering that, should we even try and help at all? Duh. Yeah. So somebody's bleeding in the middle of the street and you don't know how to sew them up so you don't try and at least stop the blood flow. You know, we always do what we can to help with as good a motivation as we can. And then, like you said, we evaluate it later and learn from our mistakes. But, you know, even if we are not fully knowledgeable, we should, you know, act. Although, if somebody has a back injury or a neck injury, better not to move them. Okay, in those situations, better to call 911, let them move the patient. But in other situations where we can do something that can help, then definitely we should do it. Yeah? Even if we can't help completely and we don't know exactly what to do. Yeah. And that's how, what's her name, Gabby Gifford, that's how she stayed alive when she was, after she was shot. That was one young man who just held her and applied force, you know, to stop the flow of blood, and that kept her alive. Yeah. So, even we don't know everything to do, then do what we can. Yeah?
What do you tell yourself in, you know, your attempt to help blow up your face?
So what about when your attempt to help blows up in your face?
What
do you tell yourself? Okay, you want to give me an example?
I mean, like, you know, you're trying to help someone, and then, you know, it looks like they get harmed instead.
Okay. Sometimes we go to our spiritual mentors, and the advice they give us is the opposite of what we want to do. And we're angry. Yeah? Then, you know, then what about that? Yeah. Is our spiritual mentor actively harming us? Or is it a case of, you know, they're ignorant? Or is it a case of, you know, we have to go through our craziness now, but in the long term we learn something very important. I mean, I'm just thinking, okay, when you all heard about my saga in Italy with Sam and the whole thing. Okay, so my teacher told me to go there. Now, I could say, oh, I went there and I created so much negative karma, getting angry at Sam, getting angry at all the other people there because they did this and they did that. And so being there, you know, I just created so much negative karma, and my teacher told me to go there, so it's his fault for me creating this negative karma. And so then from my teacher's viewpoint, does that mean that he's ignorant? Yeah, because I create negative karma by being angry now because I'm following his advice. Does that mean he's ignorant? Yeah. So we have to see, you know, what is a good motivation and what is, you know, blowing up in your face. Okay. So in that case, you know, I my teacher certainly wasn't ignorant. He was acting with compassion. And I think he saw that there were certain things I had to learn, and I have to learn trial by fire, by experience. And this was the only way I was going to learn certain things. Okay? So in that kind of case, you know, I don't think my teacher would look at this situation and say, it blew up in my face. I tried to help and it blew up in my face because she created so much negative karma getting angry at people there. Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? So, you know, on the other hand, if we really are genuinely ignorant and we have no clue what's going on and we give people really bad advice and it blows up, then we need to be honest with ourselves and say, oh, I didn't really know what I was doing, and I didn't know the circumstance well. I didn't take the time to really get enough information, and so I gave bad advice, and I'm going to learn from that. I regret what happened. I'm going to learn from it, and I'm going to really slow down in the future and get more information before I give people advice. Okay? So what I'm getting at is, just because something blows up in your face, or blows up in someone's face, doesn't mean that it's bad. Okay? Yeah? Let me ask the question here. Maybe this is a loaded question. Sometimes I've said things to people here that have made you mad. Yeah? Yes. In the end, have you learned something valuable from it?
Yes.
Okay? So...
Many times.
So, you know, I say something. I could say it blows up in my face because now somebody's mad and they're blaming me for this and that. And what do? Go to my room and cry? You know, there's no time for that. Okay? So just, you know, you have to see what the situation is. But on the other hand, if you don't know what you're doing and you give bad advice and it blows up in your face, then you got to sit down and really think about, well, what was I doing? Was I acting with wisdom, or was I Mickey Mouse compassion? Okay? And it's the situation often isn't clear to us immediately. I know for myself there's many things that I don't really understand what was going on in my own mind until years later. Because at that time my mind's too murky, I can't see it. Yeah? So, yeah, we've had that experience. What do you say, Venerable John? I made you mad a few times, haven't I?
Yes, very much so.
Has it brought some benefit?
Yeah, the Dharma would be some benefit.
Become exhausted and worn out. What is motivating you to work in a way that is, in the end, not going to be productive? Yeah? Is it really compassion that is motivating you? Or are you pushing yourself because you feel you're the one, the only one to save this person? Are you pushing yourself because you have some kind of grand expectation of, I'm going to be this great bodhisattva by doing this? You know? Are you not listening to your body because you don't know how to listen to your body when you're getting exhausted? Yeah? Are you pushing yourself because you've got to feel like you're useful? Because if you don't feel useful, then you feel you don't have a right to live on this planet. So you have to be working and doing something all the time. Otherwise, you don't deserve to eat or to live. You know. So what is feeding that thing of you know, over, you know, getting ourselves exhausted? Okay? So I think we have to feed it. I mean, we have to be aware of it. Yeah. And then recognize, you know, even if the Buddha were here, the Buddha could not solve every single problem on this planet. So why do I think that I have to, or that I'm going to be able to? Yeah, so, you know, things are dependent arisings. I have so much energy. I give what I'm capable of giving. And then I have to say, you know, I have to take care of myself, because if I don't take care of myself, then I'm going to become a pain in the neck for other people. Yeah, because then I'm going to collapse, and then they're going to have to take care of me. It's actually much kinder to other people if I prevent myself from collapsing. Yeah, so, and rest when I need to rest, and then go on doing some, you know, doing what I'm doing after I'm rested. That is much kinder to other people than wearing myself out, and then, you know, they have to take care of me because I'm a mess. I need to look at a few people in the audience. Yeah. So,
You missed one. Hmm? You missed one.
Yeah. Who did I miss? Moment that, you know, there's some small thing. Yeah. So then I have to look at some other people. Okay. Then there's people who are perfect like me that know exactly how to balance everything. Right? We all think we're the perfect one, don't we? Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's hard, and I think this is after you've been meditating for a while, you begin to see deeper and deeper layers of afflictions. Yeah, so it's just a process that you go through, and, you know, as you're able to see more and own up to more. But I think it's possible, but it's a work in progress. Not going to happen soon.
How do you distinguish when you are stretching yourself to be more like to go through laziness, mm-hmm. and when you have to take care of yourself because it's real tiredness?
Mm-hmm. One way I can tell is if there's laziness in my mind and I don't want to do something and my mind is complaining, I would put it this way. I know there's laziness when my mind is, there's a lot of complaining in my mind. Okay? And so sometimes when there's a lot of complaining, then I know I have to push through that complaining. Yeah. Then when I know I'm really tired, it's like, I'm wiped out. I have no energy. You know? The body has no energy. The mind has no energy. And that's very different than, you know, and that's the time I, you know, before I get too far on that, when I need to rest. Yeah? But when I'm complaining, then that's when I often have to. Come on, children. You know.
And the complaining for me usually is very focused outward. So when I'm tired, I'm very much checking in with myself. It's much more of an internal process.
Yeah.
The laziness is definitely a...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the complaining is outward towards other people. Yeah. But when you know you're tired, I mean, you're just checking in with your body, and your body's tired. Yeah? And you have no energy, and... You know, or you don't wait until you're thoroughly at that point. You know, it's better to stop before you get to that point. Really, it is, isn't it? Yes, definitely better. Yeah, I'm glad you agree with me. I hope you put it into practice.
Yes, I will do as directed.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, she said it. Next time, we got to hold her to it. We know each other very well here. You can't hide anything here, so... Okay. Any more questions?
Yeah. Last week, you were teaching this statement, and I would like you to say more about it. Mm-hmm. When you come out of meditative equipoise and emptiness, then there is a conventional and reliable cognizer that certifies the existence of emptiness. Mm-hmm.
Okay, because when you're in meditative equipoise, there's no thought, and the only thing that appears to your mind is emptiness. So that mind, that wisdom mind, certifies emptiness, but it's only when you come out of it, out of your meditative equipoise, that then you can have a mind that says, oh, I realized emptiness and emptiness exists. Yeah, when you're in the process of realizing emptiness, there's no thought like that going on. There's no conventional valid cognizer that's functioning. Okay?
Don't you bet you feel really well rested after that?
Yeah, I would think so, that you feel very well rested. Okay, we're kind of starting a new section now, and we only have 5 minutes left. Any more questions? I can do one more verse. Okay, so we're moving to a section that's showing that the universal vehicle scriptures are the Buddha's word. Okay, so we've just finished talking about the benefits of practicing the Mahayana, the disadvantages of criticizing it. And now Nagarjuna is going to talk about, you know, because there's people who wonder if the Mahayana sutras are actually the word of the Buddha, and so Nagarjuna is going to address that right now. Okay. And this has been an issue of controversy since, you know, for millennia. As I was saying last time, you know, what His Holiness explains is Nagarjuna lived in South India, then he was born in South India, then he traveled up to North India. He learned a lot of different sutras, he learned, came in contact with a lot of different teachings, and he was clearly a great pandit, a great sage. And so with that, he should be able to discriminate what's the Buddha's word and what's not the Buddha's word. And if, for example, if he says the Prajnaparamita Sutras are the Buddha's word, we can, you know, take his word for that, okay? But here, Nagarjuna is using some other reasons, okay? So first of all, he's going to talk about that the Bodhisattva vehicle includes wonderful practices that everybody appreciates. So, and it's kind of relating to what we were talking about before, you know, a path founded on wisdom and compassion that everybody appreciates. If the Buddha didn't teach this path, who taught it? Yeah? When you look at it, I mean, the Mahayana practices are stupendous, and the, you know, the view is stupendous, the practices, the result, everything is stupendous. If such a great thing weren't taught by the Buddha, who taught it? Somebody who wasn't fully enlightened? That wouldn't make any sense, would it? so verse 380. The nature of what the universal vehicle maintains is generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stability, wisdom, and compassion. How could it contain a wrong statement? Okay, so we just listed the six perfections plus compassion, which are all marvelous practices, and the universal vehicle scriptures explain them, and they don't explain anything that's harmful. I mean, in the universal vehicle scriptures, you don't find any bigotry. Nobody's telling you to go and kill people who are infidels. Nobody's, you know, telling you, you know, to do animal sacrifice. You know, there's none of that. It's only the teachings that are real, that we can see from our own experience, are good for ourselves and good for the world. You know, they're teaching us those kind of practices. So, you know, how could it be a wrong statement? How could it not be the teachings of the Buddha? Okay? So if we're teaching, you know, some kind of harmful practice, you know, if the teachers were saying, you know, stand upside down on your head for 3 years and you become enlightened, then, you know, okay, maybe we want to take issue with it. Or if the teachings say, you know, oh, go get drunk, and you know, or go drop acid, and that's your path to enlightenment, you know, we could take issue with that. But there's no harmful teachings. We're not encouraged to do anything that's unethical or harmful to self or others. Okay, so we'll stop here then, and then we'll start with 381. Okay. I might as well do 381 right now. It follows 380. Others' aims are achieved through generosity and ethical conduct. One's own aims through fortitude and joyous effort. Meditative stability and wisdom lead to liberation. This summarizes the universal vehicle teachings. Okay, so he just went through, again, the six perfections. So here, when it says others' aims are achieved through generosity and ethical conduct, there it's meaning others' immediate aims. Yeah. Usually in another context, they say that generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude are for others' aims. But here it's saying just the first two, and that's saying because that's acting for the immediate benefit of others, and then fortitude and joyous effort are put with actualizing your own aims because immediately they benefit you. Because when you practice fortitude, then you get rid of your anger, so your mind is happier. And similarly, when we practice joyous effort, our mind is happier. Okay, so in different contexts, they group the six perfections differently in terms of benefiting self and benefiting others. And then the practices of meditative stability and wisdom, so that's encompassing serenity and insight, especially on the nature of reality, on emptiness. And so those that realization is the direct cause for liberation. You know, without the realization of emptiness, we can't attain liberation. Okay. So, Kenzo Rinpoche, when he's teaching here, he says, at the moment, we may intellectually understand emptiness. We may know the reasons phenomena lack inherent existence or be able to explain emptiness to others. However, this does not mean we have realized emptiness. I remember at one time at one Dharma center, there was a discussion group going on, and you know, people didn't understand very well what it meant, the word realize, yeah? Because usually realize less than realizing emptiness means either a conceptual realization that you've gotten through an inferential understanding or direct perceiver. Okay? But it's a correct understanding of it. And one person said, well, what about university professors who study emptiness and teach it? Have they realized it? Because they can give the teachings on it and give you all the reasons. Yeah. And so clearly, if you understand what realize means, the answer is no. Yeah, just because you're able to explain it doesn't mean you've realized it. Yeah. And that goes for everything else besides emptiness too. Yeah, I mean, even generosity. We can give fantastic teachings on generosity, but that doesn't mean that we've realized it and we can put it into practice all the time. We might be still be very stingy. Okay. Oh, okay, so here he's saying all the bodhisattva practices can be subsumed into these six, you know, that we just went through, and they are said to summarize all the universal vehicle teachings. So meditating on these six is meditating on the meaning of the universal vehicle scriptures. Reciting the words that explain them is maintaining the words of the universal vehicle scriptures. Okay, so it's interesting. Geshe-la, remember, he was talking about words and meaning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, here we come with words and meaning. Meditating on the meaning, okay, is meditating on the six perfections is meditating on the meaning of the Mahayana teachings. Reciting the words. Yeah, reciting the scriptures or teaching or whatever is maintaining the words of the universal vehicle. Okay, so this also goes, you know, have we talked about realizational dharma and transmitted dharma? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's the same correspondence. Realizational dharma is when we meditate and actually have realizations. Sometimes we meditate and don't have realizations, but this is actually when you have the realizations. And so that's preserving the realization, not the realized dharma. And then preserving the transmitted dharma is memorizing the scriptures or being able to teach them. Okay. What's optimum is if we're able to preserve both. Then we can really be of great, great benefit. Okay, so we'll start on 383 this time.
82.
I didn't do 82? Oh yeah, you're right, I didn't do 82. Okay, so 382.
May the spiritual teacher so lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losam's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Idam Guratna Mandala Kamniryatayami. This merit may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzing Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Lord.